Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Dr. Larry Goldstein Show because from the University of Kentucky, the Ruth L. Works Professor of Neurology, the Chair of the Department of Neurology, and the Co-Director of the Kentucky Neuroscience Institute joins us, Dr. Larry Goldstein. Welcome to the program, Larry.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Our co-medical host, Rick Phillips, is out on assignment. Our website, to listen to our show, WMKY.org, that's where you can get the MP3 format of the show. Go to the main page, find us under local programming, listen to shows. We've got shows back there for years. You could easily just listen yourself silly at WMKY.org. For our research, we put that on Facebook. It's at HM Radio Show. We've recently been discussing the controversy about statin side effects on our Facebook page. We've also put one of our previous things about functional MRI scanning and memory. Take a look at that. We're always updating our Facebook page. Give us some comments and feedback. Tell us what you hate about our show, and we'll make sure we emphasize that. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, our sponsor for today's show, Stroke Symptoms, reminding you, to paraphrase Virgil, time flies, tempus fugit. Either you use it or you lose it, so you do not use it on a neurologic deficit. That's right. If you have a stroke symptom, you need to get to the attention of a medical health care provider as soon as possible. And the American Stroke Association has listed these symptoms. Grab a pencil, grab some paper. We're going to talk about these. I want you to be sure. Write this down. If you don't write it down, you have to memorize it because we want you to know these symptoms. If you or someone you love has sudden numbness or weakness of the face, arm, or leg, especially on one side of the body, they might be having a stroke. If they have sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, that is what you're looking for. Sudden trouble seeing in one or both eyes. That's a tough one, but I want you to realize that. Sudden trouble seeing one or both eyes could be a symptom of a stroke. Sudden trouble walking, dizziness, loss of balance and coordination. And again, you emphasize the suddenness. And then five is sudden severe headache with no known cause. Now, I am now officially an old man. Larry is just about as old as I am. Well-coiffed, excellent head of hair. I'm going bald, so I have these old man abrasions where I'm hitting my head constantly. And so there's no surprise that I get headaches. I hit my head on just about everything. But if you have no known cause and a sudden severe headache, that's a problem. Larry, I know you see people coming in. Is there one of these symptoms that it seems like they really don't, they discount more than others, or is it just a problem in understanding that a stroke might be happening in general?
This is a general problem, and we've been trying to address this through public education campaigns and education of family members of people who have had a stroke or at risk of stroke to try to help them better recognize the symptoms. You just went through the list of the suddens. That was one public education campaign that had been used in the past. One of the problems with it, though, is that people have a great deal of difficulty remembering them and also acting on the symptoms when they occur. Another acronym that's used, a way of trying to help people remember this, is the acronym FAST, F-A-S-T. F stands for face, and you refer to that, weakness or numbness on one side of the face, drooping on one side of the face. A, arm, holding out the arm and finding a drop down or weakness in the arm or numbness in the arm. S, speech, troubles with understanding speech, troubles producing speech, and T, the time factor. Time means that you have to act quickly. Call 911 when those symptoms happen. We can do things to reverse or try to treat a stroke, but we have to be able to do it very, very quickly. The problem with that FAST acronym is that it doesn't capture all of the symptoms of stroke, just some of the major ones. There, we've done some research at UK trying to evaluate the addition of a couple of other symptoms that are common. So what we've done is amend it to BFAST, B-E-FAST. B is balance, troubles walking, and E is eye, troubles with vision, either loss of vision in one eye or loss of vision or difficulty seeing to one side. So the BFAST actually captures more symptoms of stroke and is going to be a bit more sensitive to identification of people who are having stroke. Again, the key message, though, is that when any of those symptoms happen, not to ignore them. Even if they seem like they're going away, that could be a medical emergency. They could come back. For us to be able to treat a person to try to reverse the causes of stroke or to try to reverse the effects of the stroke, we have to be able to act and act very quickly. The T, the time of FAST.
Yeah, this message from Health Matters, you know, most of the people that have a stroke have been on this planet for at least 40 or 50 years. They have then at least a 40-year sentient adult understanding of what normal is. If something like this happens that has not happened to you before, this is not the time to take a nap and see if it will go away. Not the time to place a call to your granddaughter and ask them to get back to you when they get back in the house. This is a time to try to save as much of your brain as possible to preserve your options. And so a fast response to this is absolutely critical. I like to be fast. I actually wrote that down. I like it better than what I've got. We'll remind you in our second fractional portion, but please remember these symptoms. Again, let's go over. Sudden loss of balance, sudden loss of vision in either one or both eyes, and asymmetry of the face. The face starts drooping or the face feels numb. Difficulty in lifting the arms, difficulty in speech, sudden and onset and all these things. That means you need to call 911 immediately. You need to get yourself to an emergency room as fast as you possibly can to preserve your options and preserve your brain. That's our sponsor, the stroke symptoms, reminding you time flies, tempus fugit. Do not sit on a neurologic deficit. Get help fast if you have one of these symptoms. Larry, I was looking over your curriculum vitae and wanted to bring out a couple of things. First of all, you are a New Yorker, I believe. You're a Long Islander, and I'm not sure if I've just insulted you or if I've just, I don't know the intricacies of this. You are a Wantagh High School warrior from a long ways back.
Yes, that's right. I was born in New York and grew up for the most part on Long Island. I went to a public high school, Wantagh High School in Wantagh, New York.
And then on to Brandeis University. It's a good liberal arts school. I wonder what your major was.
It was a biology major.
Okay. So I assumed then by that time you had already decided that you might be interested in a career in medicine, or were you just really fond of biology at the time?
Well, I actually started even before I went to college in that high school, Wantagh High School. I took an AP biology course, and one of the requirements of the course was to do a research project of some kind. So at the time, there was a Scientific American cover article about memory in goldfish. So I took over a room in my high school and set up a laboratory, and we taught goldfish to respond to lights by swimming across a little barrier. And then we went to NYU and got a drug that the investigators there thought might interfere with memory, and we tested that in this goldfish model. And in fact, it did interfere with the goldfish's memory. It turned out to be a drug that was in a class called anticholinergics that we now know do interfere with memory. So I started in an interest in biology and an interest in neuroscience way back even before college. In college, I continued that. I worked in a laboratory of one of my professors who is interested in developmental neurobiology. And we were studying vulnerable brain periods during development. So that was the roots of my interest in neuroscience in particular, and then in medicine. And so when I went to medical school, I already went with an interest in neurology that I then carried through. It's one of the messages that I use try to relay commonly when I'm talking to young people who come and to discuss career choices. I just went a couple of weeks ago to the UK Medical Student Activities Council in the undergraduate school. 250 or so very young, very interested students who were deciding on careers, who had an interest in medicine. And what I talked to them about, among other things, is getting involved early in finding out what it's about early. The seeds that you plant early in your educational career are things that then are very often carried over throughout the entirety of your career. So getting that experience early is important.
Are you, I'm curious, by the way, then on after Brandeis Medical School and residency at Mount Sinai, and again staying in the Northeast, why do you think you were so interested in the human brain? The Scientific American article, I mean, the way you attempted to replicate that research in high school indicates to me that that may not have been the first brush that you had with the idea of doing research on human brains.
Brandeis was undergraduate. I went to medical school at Mount Sinai in New York. Well, it's okay. And I did residency there. But it is a fascinating area. We talk about the new frontiers or the final frontiers, and we think about space or deep sea, but understanding our brain and how our brain works is incredible. incredibly fascinating. So that was the intellectual hook. Then, in addition to that, if you think about areas of medicine where at the time we had very little in the way of therapeutics, very little in the way that we could do for people once they had a disease, it seemed like an area that was ripe for additional work, a real growth area. I think those were probably the attractions. And then finally, like, why medicine as opposed to doing something else? Again, when I talk to undergraduates or even high school students about this, you think about it, we only go around once. And what are you going to do during your one trip through life? You'd like to try to do something that's going to make a difference and make a difference for people and make a difference for people's lives. And I can't imagine anything better to achieve that goal than medicine.
After you finished your training at Mount Sinai, then Duke University, as we mentioned, a pretty long stint at Duke. What attracted you to Duke after you finished training?
After I finished my residency, I was looking for a fellowship or post-MD fellowship training and post-residency fellowship training. I was particularly interested in stroke and cerebral vascular disease for all the same reasons that I just mentioned, an area of disease that has a very high burden on the population. It destroys people's life, if not their lives. Duke at the time had a fellowship program for cerebral vascular. That's the term we use to describe the arteries affecting the brain and cerebral vascular research. So that was one attraction. The second was my wife is a neonatologist, and she was looking for a neonatal fellowship training program also. Having a two medical career family, folks are looking for fellowships, also limits choices. So it was a fortuitous choice, though, for both of us.
A very, very productive career there at Duke, full professor at the time you left. What attracted you to UK and Kentucky?
Well, after 30 years at Duke, I had been, as you said, a full professor and director of the Duke Stroke Center. What I was looking for was to be able to make the next difference, to make the next change. And building a program was one of the challenges, being able to, again, make a difference. UK was actually very well poised for this, an excellent clinical program, a very large patient population, but there was development that I thought could be done here, and UK had the resources to make that happen. That's what we're trying to do now in the Kentucky Neuroscience Institute, to take advantage of the entire breadth of not only clinical neurology, but all of the clinical neurosciences, as well as all of the incredible research that's going on here at UK, to try to integrate that, to be able to bring all of that to bear to help patients and the citizens of the Commonwealth, but also beyond by creating generalizable information.
Why don't you take a developmental break and come back for our second fractional portion? You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Health Matters. This is the second fractional portion. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Dr. Larry Goldstein Show, because we have, as our special guest from the University of Kentucky, the Ruth L. Works Professor of Neurology, the Chair of the Department of Neurology, and the Co-Director of the Kentucky Neuroscience Institute, Dr. Larry Goldstein. Welcome back, Larry.
Thank you.
Our sponsor for the second time, Stroke Symptoms, reminding you, to paraphrase Virgil, time flies, tempus fugit. Either you use it or you lose it, so do not use it on a neurologic deficit. That's right. If you have stroke symptoms, time is of the essence. And I mentioned the five that the American Stroke Association wants you to learn. And Larry put a special UK spin on this. It's called Be Fast. And again, if you have a sudden change in your balance or your ability to walk, a sudden change in the vision in one or both eyes, that's the B. F is facial, if you have a sudden change in your face so that one side of your face droops or gets numbs. A is the arms, if you have sudden inability to move, to raise your arms or control your arms. S is speech, if you have a sudden change in your ability to understand speech or to talk. then T is timing. You must get to a center that can treat you as fast as you possibly can. We recommend that you dial 911 and get ambulance help. Now, back in this has been a few years ago, back in 2012, there's something called the Behavior Risk Factor Surveillance Study, and they asked people about symptoms of stroke. They said, do you think that sudden confusion or trouble speaking are symptoms of a stroke? Well, 90% of people got that one right, so we were okay, but 10% of people didn't think that was so. Do you think sudden weakness of an arm or a leg, especially on one side, are symptoms of a stroke? 94% got that right. Do you think sudden trouble seeing in one or both eyes is a symptom? Well, only 75% or so got that. That is a tough one. It is, in fact, a symptom of a stroke. They asked, do you think chest pain is a symptom of a stroke? Well, that was 50-50. Chest pain is not a symptom of a stroke. They asked that just to see if people were paying attention. Then do you think sudden trouble walking, dizziness, or loss of balance? Well, that was about 85% recognized that. A headache, only about 60% recognized that a sudden severe headache with no known cause was a sign of a stroke. And then about 88% said, yeah, we should probably dial 911. So we know from the past, and Larry, you've mentioned, people have trouble remembering these things. And the Health Matters rule of thumb is, if something happens to you that has never happened to you before in your life, you probably ought to pay attention to that something. Don't take a nap. Don't put a phone call in. Don't text a friend or visit a chat room or anything like that. Dial 911 and get that checked out, because your options become more limited as time goes on. Larry, we talk about this. Can you talk a little bit about what happens when a person has a stroke? What is a stroke and what causes it?
Sure. A stroke occurs when there is a stoppage of blood supply to an area of the brain, or when there is bleeding either within the brain itself or around the outside of the brain that causes also secondary damage. We call the first type, when not enough blood is getting to an area of the brain, an ischemic stroke, when there's breakage of a blood vessel that causes bleeding. That's called a hemorrhagic stroke. So those are the two main types, ischemic stroke and hemorrhagic stroke. Then within those, there are a large variety of potential causes. For ischemic stroke, when a blood vessel is blocked, that can happen either because of local narrowing, usually due to, or most commonly due to, atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries, or embolic stroke, when there's material that goes from one part of the body, most commonly the heart, that then travels to a brain blood vessel and closes it off. The type of stroke that's caused by bleeding comes in two main types. When there's bleeding within the brain itself, that's most commonly related to high blood pressure, when there's a breakage of a small blood vessel within the brain, or something called amyloid angiopathy, a long term that refers to a condition in which the blood vessels may break down. Those are usually more towards the outside of the brain. Then the other major class is from something called subarachnoid hemorrhage, another long medical word. What that means is that there is bleeding around the outside of the brain. That's mostly caused by aneurysms, which are sort of balloonings of the major blood vessels that can then break and allow the blood to leak into the space between the brain and the skull. So that's called subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Now, all of these strokes then are related to the blood supply to the brain. That's where the problems are.
It's all related to blood vessels and the brain in one way. That's why the medical term for this is cerebrovascular disease. The term stroke, it also used to be called apoplexy, is because of the sudden onset. And those were the suddens that you were talking about before. These problems usually come on abruptly. But there are some vascular problems of the brain that cause problems that aren't quite as abrupt. For example, we're also very concerned now with a variety of problems that affect memory and thinking, Alzheimer's disease being one example of that. But we're now learning also that blood vessel problems can cause similar types of problems with memory or thinking. And there's a big overlap both in terms of the mechanisms of disease as well as the manifestations between blood vessel problems causing memory and thinking problems and diseases like Alzheimer's disease, things that we call neurodegenerative disorders.
So you separate out a person who's had strokes from a person who has Alzheimer's disease.
Again, this is where things become very complicated. People can have problems with thinking related to vascular disease that aren't caused by overt strokes, people who've never had an overt stroke. But in addition, having a stroke can also affect memory and thinking. So it comes in two different flavors, if you will.
You know, and if you think of this then as a problem with these blood vessels, cerebral vascular disease, the risk factors then, they follow along the same lines. We know the risk factors for heart disease and other types of diseases of the blood vessel. Age is one, let's face it. It's much more common as we get older. High blood pressure, a huge, huge risk factor for both stroke and for Alzheimer's disease and heart attack. Smoking, which is still the our unique Kentucky problem. We still have remnants of that in our state that we really need to get under control. High cholesterol and diabetes, obesity leads to a higher rate of stroke rate?
Yes.
A sedentary lifestyle, just the idea that a person does not exercise turns out to raise their risk of stroke. And then obviously if you have established heart disease, disease in other blood vessels, that puts you at higher risk. These are modifiable. These are, if you treat these risk factors, you can lower your stroke risk. And Larry, my impression is you can lower it a lot if you work on these.
Yeah, of the list that you mentioned, what we generally think of these risk factors in two major groups. These are modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. For example, you mentioned age. Age is a non-modifiable risk factor. We don't want to treat age. But age, as one ages, the risk of stroke goes up. For every decade of age over age 55, the risk of stroke about doubles. However, people at any age, including children, including infants, including newborns, can have strokes. So that concept, increasing with age, is true, but it's important to remember that younger people can have strokes also. Another major risk factor is race ethnicity. African Americans are about double the risk of dying of stroke compared to white Americans. Hispanic Americans, Hispanic Latinos are somewhere in between, a slightly higher risk in some populations, but not in others. So race ethnicity is also important. Gender or sex is also important. More men die of stroke than women. However, stroke is also a women's disease. 60% of people who die of strokes are actually women. So if you're an elderly African-American man, you, by dint of that, are at a significantly higher risk of stroke. Then when we turn to the modifiable risk factors, you described a few. One thing that's particularly interesting, though, is cholesterol. These risk factors tend to follow similar risk factors for heart disease, but not completely. And cholesterol, high cholesterol, is one example of that. What we know is that higher levels of cholesterol, particularly LDL cholesterol, is associated with an increased risk of coronary heart disease, of heart attacks. For stroke, it's not as clear. And actually, people in the general population who have lower levels of cholesterol are actually at higher risk of having a hemorrhagic stroke, that second type of stroke. So for stroke, the relationship between cholesterol and risk is not as straightforward as it is for heart disease. Also, unlike heart disease, even though high blood pressure is a risk factor, high blood pressure is a much greater risk factor for stroke than it is for heart disease. Of the treatable modifiable risk factors, the single most important is high blood pressure. So the message for people in general is to make sure that they have their blood pressures checked and checked regularly. We call it the silent killer because you don't know you have it unless it's checked and somebody figures it out until it does something bad to you. Cigarette smoking, another risk factor on your list, about doubles the risk of stroke. The interesting thing here is that environmental tobacco smoke, being around people who smoke, is as strong a risk factor as being a primary smoker. So that means families that have young children are not only exposing themselves to that cigarette smoke, but they're also exposing their children to cigarette smoke as well. And it can have a very detrimental effect on their health, not only for stroke risk, but also for other portions of their health, for example, lung diseases and other conditions. Exercise is another modifiable risk factor. Being sedentary increases the risk. Obesity, we mentioned. Diabetes is also a risk factor for stroke, as it is for heart disease. With diabetes, it's not clear that tight control of people with diabetes, that's tightly controlling blood sugar, decreases stroke risk or heart attack risk for that matter. There are maneuvers that we can do for people who have diabetes that does reduce their risk, tight control of blood pressure. The use of medications, you had mentioned statins earlier, the use of statin medications decreases stroke risk in people with diabetes.
So to be clear about the statins now, you mentioned that both a high cholesterol does carry some increased risk, but also an exceptionally low cholesterol would increase risk. But even knowing that, using these statins to lower cholesterol still seems to reduce the risk. I know you've published on that.
Yes, it's another complicated, winding answer to a simple question. For people who have established cardiovascular risk factors, treatment with a statin not only reduces their risk of coronary heart events, but also decreases their risk of stroke overall, about a 16% reduction in the risk of stroke. In people who haven't had a prior stroke, there's no increased risk of having a bleeding kind of stroke with statin treatment. The data is pretty clear. If anything, it actually is associated with a decreased risk. In somebody who has had a stroke, particularly a hemorrhagic stroke, in those folks, there may be some increased risk of a hemorrhagic stroke, although that data is far from clear and is hotly discussed and hotly debated. Overall, the overall benefit of a statin in somebody who's had an ischemic stroke outweighs that risk of bleeding.
You know, and this, we'll probably keep hitting this about the statins. There is a huge, huge debate going on in Great Britain about the side effects, about the benefits of statin therapy, with a lot of accusations between major medical journals going back and forth. And I'm sure this will spill over into the U.S. Right now, it looks at that as if the risk outweigh the benefits with the best information we have Larry's looking at me like, wait a minute. It looks as if the benefits outweigh the risk with the best information we have.
Yes, that's entirely true. The National Lipid Association has a guideline that was published about a year and a half, 2 years ago. I participated in the panel that reviewed the data. Many of the purported complications and side effects of statins seem to be a bit overblown, with little evidence to actually support them. There are some things of associated with statins that we know are potential complications. For example, muscle disease. But even in those cases, it seems to be less frequent than one might at first think. So it's not to lower the lower people's perceptions about the risk. I mean, they're real, but they have to be taken in context. If you're not alive, you're not alive to have the symptoms.
True, and thanks for that, because it is a complicated issue, but this is something you should be discussing with your doctor. And it looks like overall, at least, it's something you should consider to try to lower your risk of stroke. I know you've also published on alcohol. What about alcohol as a risk factor?
Yeah, alcohol has a complicated relationship with stroke risk. We don't recommend people start drinking to reduce stroke risk, but people who drink in moderation, which in general is no more than one drink per day for a woman, no more than two per day for a man. Women who are pregnant shouldn't be drinking at all. But that actually may be associated with some decline in stroke risk. On the other hand, excessive alcohol consumption, binge drinking in particular, is associated with an increased risk of stroke, particularly hemorrhagic stroke.
So you heard it here. Again, from Health Matters, we have repeatedly said this. It doesn't look like alcohol is a very good deal if you're thinking about starting drinking for your health. That doesn't seem like that's going to pan out. Now, we've talked about the risk factors then. We've got a couple of minutes. Can you talk a little bit about screening? Because I know you've also weighed in on that. Is there a way for us to detect whether or not we should take action against stroke apart from modifying our risk factors?
Well, I think first, again, getting back to the lifestyle and risk factors that we just talked about, what amount or what degree of reduction in stroke risk could be expected for somebody who follows a healthy lifestyle, meaning that they exercise regularly, they follow a healthy diet, which we didn't really talk about yet, don't smoke, have a good blood pressure, aren't overweight. Those people have about an 80% reduction in the risk of a first stroke compared to people who don't follow those risk factors. And the more you follow, the lower the risk. There's virtually nothing we can do with medications or other interventions that carries an 80% reduction in the risk of a first stroke. So people do need to take charge of their lives. In terms of screening, screening could mean many different things. Screening for general risk factors is quite worthwhile, particularly screening for high blood pressure, as we said, the single most important treatable or modifiable stroke risk factor. Some of the other types of screenings that may take place are probably of no benefit or actually might cause harm when it's extrapolated to the general population. One example is screening the general population for carotid narrowing, for carotid stenosis is the medical term for it. That the every major medical society in every literature review, including that of the United States Public Services Task Force and the American Heart Association, recommend against screening the general population for narrowing of the carotid artery. It can actually cause more harm than good.
You've heard this before from Health Matters. Beware of those who set up with an ultrasound machine at the Senior Citizen Center and want to just look and see what's inside you. That is almost never a good idea, and certainly in the case of screening for stroke, it is not. I'll tell you what is a good idea, taking a break and coming back for our third fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters. This is the Dr. Larry Goldstein Show because, once again, for the third time, from the University of Kentucky, the Ruth L. Works Professor of Neurology, the Chair of the Department of Neurology at UK, and the Co-Director of the Kentucky Neuroscience Institute is our guest, Dr. Larry Goldstein. Welcome back, Larry.
Thank you.
Our sponsor for the final time, stroke symptoms, time flies, tempus fugit. Either you use it or you lose it, so do not use it on a neurologic deficit. That's right. When you have these symptoms, you need to seek help immediately because the longer you go, the less brain you have. The less brain you have for the rest of your life to be with your children, your grandchildren, to think about things that are important, to write disgusted letters regarding health matters, all the things that you want to do with the time that you have left go away the longer you wait after a stroke. And again, be fast is the mnemonic that Larry likes to use, and I like it as well. B being balance and eye symptoms. If you develop sudden loss of balance and inability to walk, sudden inability to see out of one or both eyes. Fast involves your face, your arms, your speech, and timing. Fast, the F is face. If you have a sudden drooping or numbness of the face, if you have sudden inability to move your arms purposefully, if you have a sudden change in your speech or your understanding of speech, then the timing is call 911 immediately. Get yourself to an emergency health care center that can help you with this. And time is absolutely critical. We'll discuss that more in this fractional portion. That is our sponsor, Stroke Symptoms. Time flies, tempus fugit. Don't you sit on a neurologic deficit. Do not wait for these symptoms to get better or for someone to call you back. Get help immediately. That is our sponsor. Now, when we left, we were talking about the risk factors for stroke. We talked about a number of conditions such as cholesterol, smoking, diabetes, and high blood pressure particularly. You said that was one of the biggest modifiable risk factors, will have the biggest effect. And what he means about this is you have to control your blood pressure. And it's not simply you have to recognize you have high blood pressure, but you have to work with your doctor to get those blood pressure numbers down into the target area, and that's where you get the big benefit. And what we have done over the past 20 years is really learn better ways to get those numbers down. Now, Larry, I know you and I, when we started medical practice, we didn't even pay attention to the top number. It was just a number. And the bottom number we thought was life and death, and that was our focus. And I had many people in my clinic with top numbers that were higher than we would now allow, but we just thought, well, that's a part of getting older. And finding out about that top number and controlling the top number, which is very difficult to do as a person gets older, is where you get the big benefit. You mentioned diet, and we hadn't talked much about that. What do you counsel your patients regarding the best diet to keep them from having a stroke?
Well, there are several components and several different choices. The first is sodium consumption. That's salt consumption. Americans in general like salt on their foods. We add table salt to foods quite regularly. Well, sodium consumption is one of the major drivers of high blood pressure. The American Heart recommends less than 1,500 milligrams of sodium in the diet daily. If you think about it, a teaspoon of salt is about double that amount. Just one teaspoon of salt is about double that. If you read food labels, the amount of salt in prepared foods can be astronomical. If you look, for example, at the labels of a can of soup in the store, the ones with regular amounts of sodium can have 800-900 or more milligrams of sodium in them. So the first thing is to be aware of that. Restrict the amount of salt that's being added to food. When looking at food labels in stores as you're buying food, look at the sodium content. That's one of the reasons that information is there. Well, in addition to that, overall diet may also affect stroke risk. There's a lot of information bandied about diets. Very few of them have scientifically conducted randomized trials to assess their impact on blood pressure and stroke risk in particular. Two of them are the DASH diet and the Mediterranean diet, for which we do have clinical trial data. For the DASH diet, that's Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension, it's a diet that's low in sodium, high in potassium, high in fruits and vegetables, high in grains, low in saturated fats. But regardless of the individual composition of that diet, it has been associated with a reduction in the risk of stroke. People who adhere to that most closely have a much lower risk of stroke than people who adhere to it less closely. The diet itself is available free of charge. You can go to the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute or Google DASH diet, and you can get it there and download it for free, no charge. The second major diet for which we have a fair amount of data is the Mediterranean diet. This, again, is a diet that is not dissimilar from the DASH diet. There may be increased use of olive oil and nuts in the Mediterranean-type diet, but it, too, has been associated with a reduction in the risk of stroke. So when we talk about a healthy diet, those are two examples, but in particular, a reduction in sodium consumption is probably one of the more important things that people can do. The other things that reduce blood pressure are some of the other general lifestyle things that we discussed. Diet, yes, but also being physically active, watching your weight. We measure this as the BMI, the body mass index. Body mass index between 25 and 30, and you can calculate this with either an online calculator or something you can put on your iPhone. That can calculate this for you. Between 25 and 30 is overweight. Over 30 is obese. Over 35 is morbidly obese. So having a lean body mass also reduces stroke. But all of the other things that we discussed earlier can also contribute to lower blood pressure. For people in whom that isn't effective, whose blood pressure is still high, then we need to turn to medications. The old diuretics, the water pills, seem to be quite effective in reducing stroke risk in people with high blood pressure. But then the addition of other medications, as they may be necessary, for example, drugs belonging to the class called calcium channel antagonists, seem to be particularly effective in reducing stroke risk. Again, the individual choice of these medications really needs to be a conversation between patients and their healthcare providers.
Now, moving from prevention, talking a little bit more about treatment, talk a little bit about how you treat the strokes that come from blood clots, the ischemic strokes you talked about, because I know that's one that will affect many of our listeners or their families.
Right. So the first concept here is that patients don't come labeled with a neon sign that says, "Hi, I have an ischemic stroke." People come with symptoms. So the first job of the healthcare provider in the emergency setting is to try to determine whether the symptoms are due to a stroke or another condition, and then whether it's due to an ischemic stroke or a hemorrhagic stroke, a stroke where there's bleeding. If it's the first type, remember the ischemic stroke is a type when there's a blood vessel that's closed off. Our first therapeutic option is to treat with a blood clot breaking up drug. It's called a thrombolytic drug. That's the medical term for it. The drug that's available is a drug called Activase. It's tissue plasminogen activator, and that drug is given intravenously. It's given through a tube that's put into a vein. But before that can be done, we first have to establish that the symptoms are more rather than less likely due to a stroke, due to an ischemic stroke, and that we can treat as quickly as possible. Right now, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, approval for the use of this drug is within 3 hours of symptom onset. Based on a large amount of data, most stroke centers in the country will treat patients up to 4.5 hours with intravenous tPA, and our national guidelines recommend that. For that to happen, patients have to get to us as quickly as possible. Just because we have 3 hours or 4.5 hours doesn't mean that we take that long, because within that period, every minute that goes by, the benefit of that therapy is decreasing, is getting lower and lower, such that by about 4.5 hours, there's no longer any benefit. Now, even patients who are treated with tPA, most recently what we've found is that if this is caused by an occlusion or a clot in a large artery, such as, for example, the carotid artery that's in the front of the neck or one of the major arteries inside the brain, that if we can get a catheter into that clot and remove that clot mechanically, pull it out, that also is associated with improved outcomes, even in patients who are treated with those clot-busting drugs through a vein. So figuring this out and getting patients to the right place as quickly as possible is a major public health maneuver that we're involved with and other places across the country are involved with now. Well, to be able to do this, to do the evaluation quickly and effectively, to treat patients safely, you have to have a system in place to be able to do that. You can't make this up as you go along. Centers have been designated or certified by the Joint Commission. The Joint Commission is the major hospital certifying body as primary stroke centers, which are able to treat with tPA, to be able to treat with the clot-busting drug intravenously, and also comprehensive stroke centers who can not only treat those patients but also be able to use effectively the clot removal treatments where you have to put a catheter into a brain blood vessel, a tube, to remove the clot, as well as treatment of patients with hemorrhagic stroke, bleeding kinds of strokes.
So you got 4.5 hours to go from your living room through an ambulance or however you get there to an emergency room to be evaluated, to get perhaps a CAT scan or some type of x-ray to see if it's bleeding or if it's a blood clot, to get the clot-busting medicine started through the IV, or perhaps to be referred to put a catheter in the artery 4 hours from the time the symptoms start. If you can imagine anything more urgent than that, I frankly can't. And all the while, brain tissue is dying during that whole thing. That is behind the sense of urgency that makes us want you to recognize these symptoms and move fast. Time, even minutes, are of the essence on this. You know, we've got a little bit of time left, Larry. What happens then? I think many people know of a person who's had a stroke and perhaps they didn't get a chance to benefit from those, or perhaps wasn't completely treated, and they wind up then having some residual problems with the symptoms we talked about, with walking, moving the arms, the face, talking, swallowing, and so forth. What does rehabilitation really do?
Rehabilitation in one way can be thought of as a relearning, as a process to help relearning, to try to help people relearn how to use an affected limb. The biology behind this, the neurology behind it, is actually quite complicated and things that we're just beginning to understand. When somebody recovers after a stroke, and that's the goal, how does that happen? The area of the brain that was damaged is irreversibly damaged. So this may be because of what we call neuronal rearrangements, where brain cells rearrange themselves to be able to take over the some of the function that was lost. It could be through what we call compensatory mechanisms. What that means is that you figure out other ways of completing the same task or do it in a somewhat different way. For example, patients who have had their hand paralyzed as a result of a stroke, who then recover, may be able to perform and maneuver, but they perform it somewhat differently than they did beforehand. We're learning more about ways of trying to influence the recovery process. For example, use of drugs is an experimental way of doing that. Use of repetitive, high-intensity repetitive training, for example, with robots to try to help people train movements again. There are a variety of approaches that are being explored. One that was studied relatively recently in a large trial was something called forced use, which is probably not the best term for it. But basically, what's done is that when an arm is weak or not being used by the patient, they learn not to use it. So what's done in these therapeutic sessions is that the good arm is restrained. It's also called restraint-induced therapy, so that it forces the patient to use the bad arm, the affected arm, to carry out those activities. And that's been associated, at least in some studies, with an improved outcome. So there are many things that are being explored now to try to improve post-stroke recovery. But again, the key thing is that even though we may have a few hours to treat, it doesn't mean that we take a few hours to treat up front, that we need to treat absolutely as quickly as possible, because the benefit of those interventions are decreasing minute by minute.
Now we can help you recover by getting off the air as quickly as possible. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Larry Goldstein, the Ruth L. Works Professor of Neurology, the Chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of Kentucky, and co-director of the Kentucky Neuroscience Institute. Also, thanks to WUKY Operations Manager John Lamagi, to our Moorhead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote that toe-tapping Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, it's WMKY.org, or visit us on Facebook, look for HM Radio Show. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember, numerous researchers have expressed concern that listening to Health Matters might increase the risk of bleeding after a stroke. While it is true, some researchers have found an increase in hemorrhagic strokes among Health Matters listeners, there is an overall reduction in fatal strokes among our radio fans, which is reassuring. Other researchers have found that male sex, high blood pressure, low cholesterol, smoking, and diabetes are all associated with a greater risk of bleeding after listening to Health Matters. Whatever you do, Consider that many of our listeners are male with high blood pressure and diabetics who smoke. The effects of listening to Health Matters, really, they're not that significant in addition to these risk factors. Recently, a new study was published showing that people who start listening to Health Matters don't have a higher risk of stroke, and there's no increased risk of bleeding even when they're treated with blood thinners. We believe the benefits of listening to Health Matters and reducing stroke and other cardiovascular events in these high-risk listeners likely outweighs the risk of bleeding into the brain. Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of healthcare on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.